This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Aloy, sitting in for Madeline Brand. Deep below the Mojave Desert is liquid gold. Trillions of gallons of water in an underground aquifer stretching hundreds of square miles on either side of Interstate 40. It's been there for thousands of years, but only a tiny bit of it is actually tapped and harvested. So it could be a way to ease some of California's water woes. Private companies are trying to do just that, but they're running into obstacles from conservationists who question the ethics of it, and native tribes who have a spiritual connection to the water in this region. Brett Simpson wrote about the fight over California's ancient underground water for The Atlantic, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks so much for being here. So set the scene for us and describe what it is, what it's like out there. Where is this aquifer?
Yeah, so you drive out east from Los Angeles for hours, just straight into the Mojave Desert. And as you kind of reach the unincorporated Route 66, there's a fork in the road where if you turn left, you'll hit the ghost town of Baghdad, California, which still holds America's record for having the driest spell in recorded history. A century ago, it went more than 2 years without rain. And then if you turn right and drive for just a few more miles on this cracked highway, round piles of sand, you'll see the most unlikely mirage, just hundreds of acres of citrus groves. And that is Cadiz Farms, which has tapped this massive ancient aquifer to feed a modest operation. But Cadiz Inc. has much bigger plans for this water than this citrus grove.
And so you can't see, I guess, the aquifer. It's down below ground. But when did it get so full? How did the water get there? Tell us a little bit about the history of this aquifer. It's called the Fenner Aquifer, right?
Yeah, the Fenner Aquifer. Yeah, and it's a few hundred feet below ground, but it took a long time to get there. So 10,000 years ago, during the last ice age, the Mojave climate was much wetter. And during that time, when a lot of water was falling, some of it seeped down into the soil. And it just kept seeping deeper and deeper. And yeah, it's just fresh groundwater. I saw it myself coming out of sprinklers and hoses at Cadiz Farms. But it's as much as 34 million acre feet, which is about enough to fill 17 million Olympic-sized swimming pools.
Wow. And I imagine, as you said, this is not water that's necessarily renewable.
Right. So the catch is it is a non-renewable resource on a human timescale. So when we take it out, no proxy for our own civilization will ever see it replenish.
So environmentally, what are the consequences of tapping into this aquifer? I mean, there's no question California, surrounding states need the water. And if you have 17 million Olympic-sized swimming pools just kind of sitting there, I mean, what are the consequences of tapping it?
Well, the answer to that is complicated because we don't really know. But when talking to hydrogeologists, the big problem that comes up is that you can predict and you can model the impacts, you know, subsidence, effects on species. But really, this water has been accumulating for thousands of years, and the consequences are going to echo for thousands of years. So it's really hard. You know, we're not just going to see like a pit in the earth open up. And I think that it's really hard to talk about these environmental consequences.
So tell me a little bit more about this company, Cadiz. They're kind of leading the charge to tap this aquifer. Who are they and what is their big plan?
So actually, this company and its various iterations has been around for a few decades now. In the early 80s, this British entrepreneur teamed up with a geologist and bought this property likely for the water. They dug a few wells and set up an agricultural operation and then just sort of started planning this water project and shopping it around to different Los Angeles water districts like, hey, this water is here. We can run a pipeline in, you know, in various directions. And right now, I think it's important to emphasize, one, they have planned for two pipelines. One is going to connect straight to the Colorado River, and then they will sell this water, you know, down the road. Other water districts will get a little bit of extra Colorado River water. And this company, Cadiz, very much emphasizes they are, in fact, a water storage company. So they're saying they're kind of creating space in the aquifer. They're selling this water, and somewhere down the line, there will be surplus or, you know, flood water from the Colorado River that then we can stick back underground and keep it safe from evaporation.
Yeah, so break that down for us, because the storage aspect is a little bit of a head scratcher, right? Because so they're saying that we're going to tap this water that's 10,000 years old. We're going to pull it out of the ground. People are going to be able to use it as drinking water, as farming water. And then they're saying, but the other benefit is that we're going to be able to store water underground. How are they envisioning this working? Because the whole reason that we are even, I guess, considering tapping this water is because we are running out of it and we need more. And it's a little bit confusing. What water is it that they are hoping to store?
Right. So I think that they would argue, you know, with more extreme weather events, we often get, you know, a sudden influx of water and flooding, and there might be an opportunity to channel some of that water into storage. But many experts and critics that I've talked to will say, you know, okay, first of all, groundwater storage is and will continue to be extremely important in California's water conservation strategy, because putting water underground is evaporation safe. So it's like putting money in the bank. And they actually call these groundwater banks. But first of all, the state of California has a lot of empty space under it already. The San Joaquin Valley, case in point, the Central Valley is sinking. And we actually really need to refill our aquifers there.
Right. It's sinking because we've overdrawn the aquifers there.
Exactly. And it's actually a great way to kind of bring them back to health, is to store water, you know, recharge these aquifers with whatever, you know, surplus water we may have. The center of the state really needs it. And so that I think that this kind of the idea that we need to create space in one of California's only nearly untouched supplies to then store water, it's, I think, you know, it is a bit of a head scratcher. And then too, you know, as you said, this is much more to the point that they assume, you know, their same customers who are buying this water, somewhere down the line, you know, the water cycles of flood or plenty, and that's just how it is with water. So somewhere down the line, there will be a water surplus here, and the Colorado River will have this surplus. But as we're seeing, the idea that the Colorado River will ever have surplus again, I think, is really something to question and perhaps not bank on in the future.
Right. I mean, the state and six others are facing cuts potentially that would have to be imposed by the federal government because it has been drawn down so extensively. So what does Cadiz say? I mean, what's their argument for why this is, you know, vitally necessary right now?
Well, one, I think it's a big infrastructure project, and, you know, it's creating pipelines. One is going to the Colorado River, but the other pipeline, the Northern Pipeline, will go through many of these Central Valley communities that are cut off from water. And so I think that right now they're really talking about making a strong case for California's water infrastructure is broken. We are an infrastructure project. We can bring water, you know, not just to wealthy Southern California neighborhoods, but to other folks who need it. And yeah, I think that that goes back to this question, this very essential ethical question is, should we take this water out? Should we take it out now? And who's it going to?
Well, and what's, I guess, stopping them from doing that? I mean, before we, because I want to get into the ethical part of this, but what's stopping Cadiz right now from jumping feet first into this?
Right, yeah. So there are several, it's been through several cycles of legal battles, and as the political winds have shifted, different approvals, different rejections. You know, Obama's Department of the Interior rejected a crucial right-of-way along a railroad line for one of the pipelines, and then Trump's BLM then reversed that. And now, you know, it then went back to a judge, and Biden went in the other direction, and so or the judge under Biden. So I think it really is, there is a political back and forth. And yeah, these legal battles from conservationists and also the Chemehuevi tribe, which for them, Bonanza Springs, if it is connected, it is protected under the Mojave Trails National Monument, and it is a sacred stopping point in their Salt Songs Trail ritual, which is an ancient ceremonial loop through the desert of 142 songs that they sing at these sacred stopping points along the way. And it's a kind of spiritual and physical description of a landscape is embedded in these songs.
So that does get us to the ethical quandaries here. Can you describe that conflict and this idea? I guess I don't want to say it's a growing movement. You write about how it's been around for a really long time, but this idea that we can kind of no longer be divorced from thinking about where our water is coming from, that we can't just turn on our taps and expect it to be there anymore.
Absolutely. Ethics and water have been intertwined since time immemorial. We can assume, you know, as long as we've been relating with each other, we have been sharing water or competing for water. And I think that that biological imperative, the fact that we need it to survive, really differentiates this from other non-renewable resources that we might talk about that may lay under a desert. And it also makes it even more, as these ethicists would argue, and then of course the tribal leaders as well, that for the past century or so, water rights decisions have had this emphasis on technical and economical questions. And, you know, of course, legal, but those are ethical to the point of property ownership, i.e. I own land downstream, you can't take it all before it reaches me. But the fact is that nobody has this purely economical relationship with water. We need it to survive. And in this age of scarcity, of transboundary conflict around water, they're arguing we need to put ethics in the forefront of these decisions. And we need to at least acknowledge that this is a part of the conversation, because right now there's nothing explicit in California law that protects ancient non-renewable water from being sold to the highest bidder.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. You know, ethics are subjective. So how do you use subjective considerations to set policy that will ultimately affect everyone?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is exactly kind of the set of questions that do kind of make us tend toward the economical or the technical challenges, because those might be a little bit easier to solve. But when we take these questions out of the conversation, you end up with really, really bizarre policy in the end. So I think that actually these water ethicists would be very uncomfortable with being too prescriptive or giving you a set of, you know, do's and don'ts. It may be that the best thing is to take this water out. They're just saying, ask the questions first. You know, if this resource has been here for 10,000 years, should we take it or should we leave it for future generations? Will they need it more? What are our alternatives right now? Is it going first to the people who need it most? So I think that it's opening up a set of questions that, yes, it might be tough to create policy around this, but right now it might not, it also might not be at the forefront of our policy conversations.
So what's going to happen? How do you see this ending?
Yeah, well, I've heard a joke that this project's popularity tends to cycle with droughts. So the way it's looking now in our mega drought, it could be that it starts to make a lot of sense to a lot more people. We don't know. If you ask Cadiz, they're well on their way. And, you know, these legal battles continue. At this point, time will tell. So far, time has been on this water's side, but we'll have to see.
Brett Simpson, you can read her big piece about the fight over California's ancient water in the Atlantic. Brett, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on this show, you can make a record out of, well, a lot of things. And during the Cold War, people in the Soviet Union did just that, using old X-rays. The story of bone music, next on Press Play.